It's Ideasphere with political science professor Peter Matthews, Dollar Democracy.
It was just amazing to say that the corporation is a natural person with human rights. And this was a monstrous decision. I think it created a Frankenstein monster in a sense that grew out of control. Because before 1886, corporations were temporary entities granted a charter by state governments to carry out a specific purpose while making profits.
According to political science professor Peter Matthews, America's democracy is stuck in a quagmire. Polls consistently show that Congress does not have the respect of the voters. There's a very good reason for that. As Matthews points out, voters are underrepresented. Hello, I'm Guy Rathbun. Welcome to Ideasphere, a platform for today's voices. My guest, Peter Matthews, ran for public office a number of years ago. What he discovered may not surprise you. If you don't take corporate lobbyists or PAC money, your odds of winning are extremely slim. If you do take their money, you're permanently indebted. Matthews' new book, Dollar Democracy with Liberty and Justice for Some, covers a gambit of issues from buying American politics, the economy, education, healthcare, Wall Street, and so much more. Matthews has spent 30 years as a college and university professor of political science, currently teaching at Cypress College in California. He's a featured political analyst on Head On radio show in Los Angeles. Professor Matthews, thanks for taking this time.
It's my pleasure being here. Thank you so much, Guy.
Let's begin with your awakening about 20 years ago when you decided to run for state office, and you made a decision that hampered your campaign.
Yes. From the very beginning, I decided that I would not be bought and paid for, by as many politicians unfortunately are, by the big corporate lobbyists and PAC committees that want special interests rather than the public interest. I said, I'm not going to take that kind of money, so I'm going to try to just raise small amounts of money from friends. And if those who want, individuals want to donate money, that's fine, and get involved as volunteers in my campaign, even more importantly. And we ran a pretty strong campaign in 1998, for example, when I won 45% of the vote against the incumbent moderate Republicans, 52%. 45 to 52 is what we lost by, but I consider it a victory since we were outspent 6-1 by him and we refused corporate PAC money and lobbyist money.
One of the startling things that occurred, and I'm sure I get the impression it happened to you as well when you heard the words, when the California League of Conservation Voters told you that, well, we know that you'd vote along our ideals 100% of the time, but we're going to be going with your opponent, even though it only represents possibly 60% of the vote.
Yes, I was competing against a corporate lawyer, a Democrat also. The California League of Conservation Voters, first of all, are really good people. They've done a very good policy advocacy for cleaning up our environment and making it sustainable and for new energy. I'm with them about 100% of the time on my issues, and they loved my interview. It was so comfortable with them. And I thought I was going to ace it, and I did ace it, and that they were going to endorse me. But when the corporate lawyer was brought in, apparently, because later on that night they called me and said, Peter Matthews, we love your ideas, your philosophy, and your understanding of the technical side of the issues. And we know you'll be 100% for us in Congress if you get there. But we're endorsing your opponent. He's another Democrat, but he's going to probably vote for us about 60% of the time. But we're going to endorse him because he is financially viable. That's the word they use, financial viability. He has $165,000 already in his campaign account in June before the March election the next year, 9 months early. He's already raised $165,000, Peter Matthews, and you've only got $5,000 in your account. And I told him why. I said, I don't take any money from corporate lobbyists, unlike him and others. And they said, I'm so sorry, but you're going to have to win for us to do anything. So we're going to endorse him. And if by chance you make it through the primary, we will give you 100% of our support against the Republican in November. Well, it just so happened that endorsement was very important because he was able to portray himself as an environmental lawyer, jogging on the beach and talking about cleanup and all that. And yet his company, his law firm, was representing the company that was contracted to put low-level radioactive waste in Ward Valley along the Colorado River. Every time in a debate this came up, he would say, I can't talk about this because my company is involved in it. But most of the voters didn't even see him or hear him. He just sent out about 10 mailings building up his whole... It's Madison Avenue advertising. So he won the election by 51% to 49%, the primary election. And I would say that if the California League of Conservation Voters had gone with me on this and put their volunteers and a good seal of approval on my campaign, I could have possibly beat him. and gone on to win. Yeah, but it didn't happen. Even the good people like that, I was showing in my book, good public interest people who want to support the public interest and clean up the environment and bring better jobs and those kinds of things, fall for this whole dollar democracy. They bought the system of how we elect these corporate-dominated candidates. They bought it hook, line, and sinker. And their argument, some of our progressive friends who have gone for this, say that you've got to win first. You cannot do anything unless you win, and you've got to win. So take the money from the corporate lobbyists. Take our money and our support, but take theirs also because you need the money to win. And then you can see what you can do for us. And this is why we end up with not even half the loaf, the progressive side. We get sometimes a quarter of the loaf. And that's why I'd like to let the listeners know about Senator Paul Wellstone, my good friend, who won without corporate money, the U.S. Senate seat in Minnesota in 1990. He once said, politics is not about power. Politics is not about money. Politics is not about winning for the sake of winning. Politics is about the improvement of people's lives. And I just love that statement because it puts it back to where politics is really all about, the original meaning of the word. Old version of politics, that is, the word comes from the word Greek word polis, right? Community.
Right.
Which means if you're political, it's a good thing because you're a full citizen. You're taking part with, for, and by the affairs of the community. Involved every day about improving the public interest, which also affects and improves our individual interest.
It's interesting that while I was reading your book, a Central California newspaper columnist, Steve Provost, wrote a piece about money in politics, and he was talking about how he avoids all of the flyers and commercials and everything else that lead up to election day. And he votes before the polls open, as many are doing now. But he was talking about how the money, billions of dollars, are already flowing into the coffers, even though we're months away from any election.
Yes. Matter of fact, in 2012, in the presidential and national elections, it was almost $10 billion that flowed through the campaign coffers by independent expenditure committees and those who donated to individual congressional candidates, Senate candidates, and the U.S. presidency. And we had one of the lower voter turnouts. The money is not what's getting people to go out and vote. It's what's keeping them from voting, many people, is the sense of alienation, the sense that we voted so many times before to people that promised us the world. And they didn't deliver, and the public doesn't know why they were not delivered to. That's what this book does. It brings the connection between the campaign contributions and the lobbying money and the lack of delivery of the real public interest.
Right, and this is exactly where you write, politics has been reduced to a science and mechanics of winning elections.
At any cost.
At any cost. So what you discovered is that once a candidate wins the election, the first thing they have to do is start campaigning for re-election.
That's right, especially in the House of Representatives, which is only a two-year term. But even in the U.S. Senate, it's a six-year term, but they start immediately raising money because it's got to be dozens of millions for the Senate and $1.7 million for the average House winner. That's how much they raise and spend in a two-year cycle, guy. $1.7 million. That's a huge amount of money. And you wonder what they're going to owe after that.
And it's so counterproductive.
Yes, it is. It really is because it goes against the public interest. These elected leaders are just unable, even when they speak a good line, and some of them may believe what they're speaking and saying that they want to make a better society. Their hands are tied because of those who've given them the big bucks, and they know that in less than 2 years, they've got to go back for the same amount of money again. You see what a cycle it is, and that's why I'm supporting reforms like clean money elections and a move to amend the 28th Amendment of the Constitution, which is the We the People Amendment. We'll talk about that as we go along here.
In case you're just tuning in, Dollar Democracy with Liberty and Justice for Some, How to Reclaim the American Dream for All. Peter Matthews, professor of political science and author of the book. Speaking of counterproductive, in the chapter you have on education.
Yes.
Now, this is something we all are so painfully aware of. Education has become a commodity that is out of the reach of most of the population because of the costs.
Yes, indeed. And the sad thing is that California was a pioneer in making education totally attainable because in 1960, our governor, Pat Brown, the father of the present governor, Jerry Brown, pushed for a master plan for higher education. He got it through the state legislature, and we implemented it. And that master plan called for tuition-free education all the way through university, law school, medical school, engineering school. In fact, Governor Pete Wilson, our former governor in California, paid $37 for all 15 units, a full load of law school classes per semester at UC Berkeley at that time. And then came the Governor Schwarzenegger, who went to school at Santa Monica College, a community college where I've taught before, He paid $6 for all 15 units service fee. There was no tuition whatsoever. And by the way, most European students are doing the same thing. They have a tuition-free system over there. But we've taken away from our people in California, our young people. And this will be the first generation that will do worse than their parents economically if things keep going the way they are. And a big part of the crisis is the taking away educational opportunity, which, by the way, was the United States of America. We are the ones who invented public education. We had pioneers like Thomas Jefferson. We had Horace Mann. We had John Dewey, Susan B. Anthony, people who are really pushing for equal access to develop your human potential. How are we human if we don't have the ability to develop fully our human potential to become whatever nature or God has intended us to become? And I believe that every one of us has more than one talent. You can be a doctor and a musician, and you should be able to do both as a human being. That's the best society that provides those opportunities. And we took it away from the California young people. And that's a social sin, in my view. It's a social crime.
One of the startling pieces of information I think folks are going to really get a hold of in reading your work, that is the cost this means for corporations, the cost in skilled workers. What they have to do to find skilled workers is go overseas, which undercuts and undermines education, which further erodes the potential for skilled workers in America.
Yes. That is exactly what's going on, and the corporations and their leadership know it. And they are just as satisfied, unfortunately, with bringing in Indian computer scientists to write the programs and the software here or contracting it through electronic commerce in India. For example, Microsoft is now getting a lot of its software written and programming done in India at the computer parks in Hyderabad that they set up over there. And they pay the Indian computer scientist and computer programmer one-fourth the wage they would pay an American salaried graduate from college here. And that's just completely undercut our people's chance, even in the high-tech and information technology industry, to have good middle-class jobs. In the 1950s, 30% of our workforce was manufacturing, producing solid products that were exported all over the world and here in the United States. And now it's down to 9% of our workforce, from 30% to 9% in the last 50 years or so. And no country can be strong economically or democratically, because the word democracy means rule of, by, and for the people. We can't do that without a large middle class that produces enough income and wealth for itself and be able to share in that wealth so that we have shared prosperity, and then people have free time to think critically about what philosophy is about, what politics is about, which form of ideas are most spiritual and the best for us. Those kinds of critical thinking skills are a big part of education, and they are this twin pillar. You have technology education and you have critical thinking education, both of which were American strong points not long ago. And we're eroding that on purpose. When I say we, it's the corporate elites who say, we don't want to pay taxes. We're creating jobs. So you got loopholes. Can you believe that Facebook paid zero income tax in 2012 while making $1.2 billion in profit that year? And they received a corporate subsidy from the government of $429 million to promote themselves around the world. So Facebook ended up with a negative tax burden of 40%. And that's not just Facebook. Apple hid $15 billion legally in corporate loopholes called the offshoring loophole last year. They needed to pay $15 billion. If they did not have the loophole, that would have brought a lot of jobs and education, et cetera, and research for our people. It was avoided by Apple, and they're hiring workers in China through their contractors a little over $1 an hour to put the iPhone together. And these workers are so distraught. They're working 10 or 11 hours a day, 7 days a week. There was a time not long ago in summer, a lot of the human rights groups are saying they're still doing it. Some of these workers are jumping off the roofs of their dormitories trying to commit suicide. That's been documented.
That was prominent in the news for a short period of time.
Those kinds of things are still going on, and the type of work conditions are going on, but the news is kind of ignoring it, unfortunately. But there's human rights groups like China Labor Watch. Those groups are still on top of it, and I'm getting reports saying that a lot of these conditions have not changed in China, and yet Apple and Samsung and all those hire Foxconn, City, and other corporations that I talk about in my book. Those are the manufacturing parks are like little towns. They have 60,000 young people mainly in such inhumane conditions. First of all, they don't hire middle-aged or older people. The women are given pregnancy tests when they're hired to make sure they're not pregnant. Let me give you an example. When one of the Apple executives decided, it was the top person, they're going to put glass coverings on the iPhone. All of a sudden, he decided that so that would set Apple apart from other manufacturers. He gave the order, and other Apple executives said, they went to China and said, can you do this for us? And the Chinese government actually subsidized the space for the factory to do this, and they got the contract over there. They woke up these Chinese workers in these dormitories at 3 in the morning, gave them a cookie and a cup of tea, and said, get to work, because this has to be done in 6 weeks. They started working that day. They worked 10 hours that day, 11 hours, 7 days a week, and had to continue working 6 weeks, I believe it was, to get this thing down. It was done. And here's something else, Guy, you would be amazed at and flabbergasted if you think about it. When President Obama asked Steve Jobs at a luncheon in Northern California, I believe it was, a few years ago, "Mr. Jobs, can you please bring some of those Apple jobs back from China? We need middle-class jobs here. Can you bring those jobs back here?" And he said, "Mr. President, these jobs are never coming back." And the reason he gave was not so much the labor cost, although that's the big part of it, but it would only cost about 10% more to assemble an iPhone here than it would in China. The difference is the type of workforce, that army of labor that is treated like feudal serfs, that can get up at 3 o'clock in the morning and work for 10 hours a day, they would never get away with that in the United States. And he said, "We have a disciplined workforce in countries like China." And then another executive said, "We're not in the business of helping the American economy. We're in the business of building the best iPhone." It's that amorality, non-morality, that strikes at the heart of our condition today that has to be really changed if we are to regain our strength as a nation and our moral fiber, especially in corporate America. Regular Americans are great people. We believe in fairness. We believe in ethics and morality, most Americans. And if they knew what was going on in China, they would be abhorred by it.
I want to give you a chance to give any websites and blogs or tweets or anything else that you want to promote.
Sure. My website is epetermatthews.com. And Matthews is spelled with one T, M-A-T-H-E-W-S, epetermatthews.com. And they can go there, click on the Buy Now tab, and then I can sign the book and mail it out to them directly, autograph it if they like. Or they can go ahead and click on the upper right-hand corner of the homepage. You can buy this at Amazon, and you click on that. The picture of the cover of the book is up there. You click on that, and it goes right to Amazon where they can order it directly. Or they can go to Barnes & Noble's. They picked up my book now, which is very exciting. Not saying we should support big corporate bookstores, but in this case, they're getting the word out for us. So we're not against
right. That
too much, that part of it.
Talking with political science professor Peter Matthews, epetermatthews.com is his website. The book, Dollar Democracy with Liberty and Justice for Some, How to Reclaim the American Dream for All. This is now available in softcover. You're listening to Ideasphere. I'm Guy Rathbun. We'll be right back. Back with Ideasphere, a platform for today's voices, political science professor Peter Matthews, his book, Dollar Democracy with Liberty and Justice for Some. I have a feeling our discussion is going to raise a number of questions. So we have a democracy that's failing its constituents. It's bought and paid for, as you say, by the corporations owned by the rich, primarily by the 1%. So how do we get it back?
Yes.
Where do we begin?
We begin with informing our people and illuminating them about what's really going on and the intricacies of it. Because most people have a feeling that things are just not right here in America, that their children will not do as well as the parents did. And many people are working overtime and double time to make ends meet, and they have less time for their children also. And so they know this. The parents, quite a few of them, are paying the tuition bills and seeing them going up. So to show them how and why these policies that are made by government, which has been bought and paid for by corporate interests, are bringing about those high tuitions for them, and how it's dismantling our K-12 education, for example, where it's really sad. Two-thirds of our schools are having terrible times, and part of that's because of the funding is based on property taxes. But that's another thing. That's through dollar democracy. And also you show the American people how dollar democracy is affecting our environment. It's causing our air and water supply to be polluted. In many cases, 20% of our drinking water is unfit for drinking. Part of that has to do with fracking, about how these big oil companies are able to go underground there and inject water and chemicals and blow up that area in order to release gas and oil from shale rock. The state legislators who got to vote on a moratorium bill to hold off on fracking till we can get the actual medical implications of it, moratorium would have been a temporary hold off on fracking, stopping it in order to do this. And yet those state legislators, and many of them were Democrats, we have a Democratic-dominated legislature, but all the Republicans and the majority of Democrats voted against the moratorium. And it so happened, those who voted against the moratorium on fracking, the pro-oil position, had received seven times the amount of money from campaign contributions from the oil companies and gas companies than those who voted for the moratorium. There's a numerical correlation there. And to hear these politicians come to us and say, well, the money doesn't affect our vote. We make our independent judgment. The money only helps us get the message out. That's so egregious. And, you know, I don't believe them at all when they say those things. So every one of those areas I deal with in my book, our education, our environment, our food supply, GMOs, for example, genetically modified foods, which more and more people are finding out about, are really not good for our health, for our digestion, our immune systems. And when industry-backed scientists do the research, they come out and say everything is just fine. GMOs will help us feed the world. And the FDA goes right along with it. That's because the FDA itself doesn't have the right appointees there. For example, President Obama appointed Michael Taylor, a Monsanto lobbyist and former vice president, to be an assistant director at the FDA dealing with veterinary issues and food issues. It's like the fox guarding the chicken coops. You wonder why President Obama appointed someone like that instead of appointing one of the moms across America, one of the people who are involved with the academic research like Jeffrey Smith on GMO foods of the Institute for Responsible Technology. That's a public advocate. So we need those kinds of people. But Congress and the presidency have a lot of influence from these big corporations, agribusiness, which is how Halliburton Corporation was able to lobby through Dick Cheney's influence on the Clean Water to get an exemption, as the oil and gas companies, the whole industry got an exemption from any kind of implications on the Clean Water Act of their actions. It's the only industry, oil and gas industry and coal industry, that received an exemption for any of their actions from the Clean Water Act effects on the Clean Water Act. And we know that fracking has a major impact on water supplies. That's been coming out in research in Pennsylvania. A film called Gasland, we've made it very accurately, that showed a water faucet in Pennsylvania, a man opening up his water faucet, the water is coming out of the faucet. He lit a match, and the water went up in flames.
Something you mention in the reference to corporations early in your work, quoting that we should, as a country, have a moral obligation. But more importantly, you say it also raises questions about whether or not corporate America has a moral obligation to Americans.
Yes.
Well, this could apply across the board for all corporations and all activities, including the Food and Drug Administration.
Absolutely, because it is morality and ethics, the universal principles of morality and ethics that guide the good society, the healthy society that creates the good life for people to have opportunity to enjoy the good life and the American dream, for example. And without that moral fiber, that ethical compass, that is not going to happen. And you've seen over and over and over again when corporations make statements like, we have no obligation to help the American economy. We have the obligation to make the best iPhone in the world. That's completely saying that we are just purely material beings. But we know that. Those of us who are thinking individuals, those of us who have spent time pondering the question of why we're on this earth, well, how is our relationship to each other connected to a higher sense of purpose? Those of us who know those things and feel those things, and most Americans with common sense, which I know that most Americans are wonderful about caring for each other and for the world as well in a rational way, these people, our people, know that morality and ethics makes a difference. They even teach their children that. And it's not just corporate America. It's global. Those who own General Motors aren't just Americans. They are people from around the world that are invested in GM and have a stake in making lots of profit. The same thing with Mitsubishi. It's not a Japanese company. It's owned by investors all over the world. These are global multinational corporations that have become amoral. They have no loyalty to any country or society, just to their bottom line. And that's where we, the people, have to make a demand on them. We have to heed Frederick Douglass's words that power concedes nothing without a demand. And that's where we're coming in to say we need to amend the Constitution. We need to have a 28th Amendment, a We the People Amendment, and there is one already that's been written. It's been sponsored by two members of Congress. They've introduced it in the House, and there are 70 or 80 co-sponsors in the House for this amendment, and there's a massive grassroots group called Move to Amend Coalition. They have a website, movetoamend.org. This is 455,000 people who have signed this petition to get their local members of Congress to go ahead and join that group in the House to introduce the amendment, and the Senate as well, to get it going and pass it through Congress and then go to the states with it. So this is what we need, a 28th Amendment that would remove corporate personhood and say that money is not speech. That's what the 28th Amendment does. It's called the We the People Amendment. Remove corporate personhood and declare that money is not speech. Two egregious rulings by the Supreme Court that came down many decades ago that has hurt democracy. So the people of America are taking things in their hands with this We the People Amendment.
And Supreme Court Justice John Stevens, you quote from 2010, saying, corporations have no belief, no feelings, no thoughts, no desires. And yet they are given the same rights as people.
Isn't that amazing? 1886, the Supreme Court decision, Southern Pacific versus Santa Clara County. I don't know what they were smoking when they did it, but it was just amazing to say that the corporation is a natural person with human rights. And this was a monstrous decision. I think it created a Frankenstein monster in a sense that grew out of control. Because before 1886, corporations were temporary entities granted a charter by state governments to carry out a specific purpose while making profits. A lot of them were chartered to build canals, and they were allowed to charge a profit fee for the canal usage. And once they recouped their costs, the limit on the corporate charter said that they could only make 12% profit above their costs, after which time the corporation is out of business unless they renegotiate a new contract for a new purpose by the state. So it really put the people in control of the economy and democracy back then until 1886, when the Supreme Court said corporations are persons. And now the most egregious results of that was the Hobby Lobby decision, which says that corporations can deny their employees contraception because the corporation has a conscience, a religious conscience. How crazy is that? It's amazing that the Supreme Court 5-4 decision made that ruling recently, and that's the absurdity of corporate personhood.
It's interesting you have to go back over 100 years to come up with the robber barons and their chokehold on government, which, as you tell, isn't really dissimilar from today.
That's right. In fact, many of the Supreme Court justices were very close friends of the railroads who wanted complete power to do whatever they wanted to, and the court gave it to them because of the influence that they had on the court and the court members and the thinking of the corporate elites who supported it. And that's what happened in 1886. So there are other rulings like Citizens United, and Buckley versus Vallejo in 1976, in which the court decided that money is equal to speech. How absurd is that? I've never heard a dollar bill speak by itself. It's actually a megaphone that amplifies speech, which can also drown out other speech. You need to even the playing field when it comes to speaking, and that's where the clean money election that was brought in Maine and Arizona, the two pioneering states on that. And the state of Maine passed it in 1996, I believe, and implemented in 1998. And it set up a system to this very day that exists in Maine, where if you're running for state assembly, you can become a clean money candidate by raising $5 from 65 people in your district who are registered voters. Then you turn the $304 over to the election commission, which then qualifies you as a legitimate clean money candidate. And you also have to sign a pledge that you would not accept any private money, including your own, for your campaign. Instead, the government writes you a check for several thousand dollars, and you have the clean money label. And then you go out and campaign by listening to people, not staying on the phone half the time begging for money from the rich corporate elite.
Professor Matthews, thank you so much for the time you've given today. I think we could easily spend another hour talking about this, I'm sure.
It is my pleasure. And thank you so much, Guy. I really appreciate it. Take care.
Take care. Professor Peter Matthews, Dollar Democracy with Liberty and Justice for Some. Check out his website at epetermatthews.com. If you have any questions about these broadcasts, write to me at rathbunproductions@gmail.com. This program is a distribution of Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org. For Ideasphere, I'm Guy Rathbun.